I actually started as a boy soprano, and I have a vivid memory of singing Moonlight Bay in first grade with Mrs. Poole in two-part harmony with Ralph Russell. How do I remember a name from a first grade, but I remember that. When the voice change occurred, it's kind of like the bottom came in, and I didn't really lose a whole lot of top, because I guess I was singing through my voice change, which makes a big difference. So it's not like the bottom came in and then I had to rebuild the top. I was able to keep the top. So I sang bass in high school. And I think it dropped even more in college, because I was second base all through college.
At Capital, right?
At in Capital Ohio? University, mm-hmm. Yes. They had a conservatory of music there. And when I was a kid, my mom and dad would always take me to the chapel choir concerts. They had a Christmas concert series. And they had two concerts on campus and then a Sunday afternoon concert at the Ohio Theater, which seats like 3,000 people or something like that. So I remember a sold-out Ohio Theater for a choir concert. You know, it was just tradition to go to their concert. So there wasn't a whole lot of decision-making when it came to choosing a college. I wanted to be part of the chapel choir, you know, so.
That's fantastic. Were your parents musicians?
Not professionally. My mom played some piano and organ, and she was kind of like a substitute organist for the church choir and church services. My dad, when he was in high school, was an all-state singer, and he would often sit at the piano and play by ear and just, you know, plunk out melodies and things like that. But I think the most important thing was that they understood how important it was for the four of us kids to get a music education. So we all had piano lessons, and we all took an instrument at some point. And very early on, my folks started me with singing lessons as well, because they saw that I had something going there. So
yeah, well, that's a priceless gift for sure, you know? Yeah. That's wonderful. So you were in college as a voice major, and before you went on to grad school, like, what was your vision of your future?
Actually, my original major at college was composition, theory and composition. But I was so active as a vocalist that a couple extra courses gave me a dual major as a voice performance major in theory composition. A couple of my professors were Eastman graduates, and they suggested that I apply to Eastman for graduate work. Excuse me. And they, you know, I kind of laughed at that. And I said, really, Eastman? I don't think so. But I applied anyway, and lo and behold, they accepted me, and I was a composition major there for a year. I studied with Warren Benson and did some work with Sam Adler. And a couple music education professors were working at the downtown church where I was doing an experiential worship service. And they got a hold of me and suggested that music ed might be a better avenue for me.
So what were you doing at that church that piqued their interest?
The experiential worship service was a very unique service in that the congregation were participants in the service itself. So if you can imagine a classroom where students learn by doing and not just by listening, that's kind of what the service was based on. And so it was a very sensory experience where, you know, we tried to cover all of the senses, taste and touch and hearing and sight and role-playing and drumming and dancing and just all kinds of things. So every week was a creative experience, and I was given carte blanche to do anything with music that could weave itself through this service and make that service a more meaningful experience for those who participated. And that taught me an awful lot about education in general and how important it is to get away from lecture and make the classroom a participatory experience.
Well, I'm impressed because I've been to a lot of different churches, and my general impression is that for a lot of people, church is a very passive experience. You know, they go in and they are ministered to. To get your congregants to sing is one thing. To get them to, you know, act and dance is, you know, that must have been a really wonderful education experience for them. And you were teaching, basically.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Yeah.
So they talked you into going into education.
Yeah, they said that the kind of things that I was doing there would make me a valuable educator. And they were able to move me through some of the undergraduate music ed courses that I needed to graduate. And with a year and a summer of extra work, I was able to get all my methods in and the psychology classes and things like that. So it worked out for the best.
And you did it for 30-some years at Spencer Poor High School?
32 years, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Had a wonderful program there, and I spent my entire career there, and I started with a choir of 15, a fledgling music theory class, and the band program was in a similar situation with instruments in disrepair, and an iconic teacher named Terry Taylor, and I started the same year at the high school. And we had a administration who was bound and determined to build a music education program that was respectable. And so we had a lot of support from them. And when the parents started seeing what we were doing with the kids, we started getting parental support. And that just grew and grew. And now there's 3 bands, 2 jazz bands, 4 choirs, 2 levels of music theory. There's lessons, both choral and instrumental. 4 staff members at the high school, and just a wonderful situation.
Yeah, nice legacy.
Yeah,
that's really sweet. Yeah. So how hard was it for you to walk away from that when you decided to retire?
Oh, that was the most difficult decision I think I've ever made. I certainly thought about it for probably a year and a half and pondered the pros and cons and just decided that, you know, that particular year was the right time to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you about things that you saw in that 32 years at Spencer Port in terms of the nature of students. You know, when I was in high school, students seemed to be sort of pigeonholed. There were the jocks and the band nerds and the singing nerds, and people had their sort of like their lockers of association, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now it seems like there are the kids that do everything. They run track, they're in the play, they play in the jazz band, and then there are the kids that do nothing. I mean, what was your experience like in Spencer Port?
I think it was probably the same all the way through. I certainly had a wide variety of students. Theory, I think, was particularly interesting in that, yeah, we had the nerds, but I also had the garage banders that weren't involved in any other music, but they played guitar in a band, in a rock band, and they wanted to take music theory and, you know, learn how to write songs and things like that. So that was really fascinating. And I've had some students go on to some pretty nice rock careers as one of my garage band students, you know, and I'm just as proud of them as I am the music educators and the award-winning performers that I've had.
Well, they're probably
over the
wealthiest graduates from your program.
Probably so, yeah.
Oh, man. What is it about music that, especially for young people, just kind of infuses their soul with passion and interest like nothing else?
Well, I've always thought of music as a pathway to the soul. And once you reach the soul, lives change. And it's not just an educational thing. It's a physical thing. I had experience in college. We were on tour. I think we were in Florida. And
tour with a choir?
Yes. And the choir is an a cappella choir. And we were similar to the St. Olaf tradition of choir, collegiate choir singing. As a matter of fact, we had interchange with St. Olaf quite a bit while I was there.
Did you memorize your music?
It was all memorized.
Did you hold hands?
We did not.
Okay. That's good. I always thought their hands must get really sweaty, you know?
But we were in concert, and I don't recall what we were singing, but there was a measure where everything was perfectly in tune, and everybody felt it. It was like goosebumps all over the place. There was a physical reaction to perfect in-tuneness, and I guess I spent my entire career looking to, you know, replicate that. Never did.
Well, but what did that moment feel like physically?
Oh, it was shivers, and we all looked at each other and what the heck was that? And after the concert, did you? Yeah, I did, and it was the body, I guess, resonated. As part of a natural thing. You know, the Greeks got that with the harmony of the heavens. And I always talk about that with my kids, that, you know, music is not something that some guy invented at some point. It's just we're tapping into what's already out there. And I think the kids understand that as well, because the act of singing in a choir or playing in a band with other people brings them together like nothing else they've ever experienced. And so there's a bond that's created and a family that's created. And like with music rooms all across the country, it's a place where the kids hang out. And I had kids that were claiming spots, you know, in my office where they would keep their things rather than the locker, because, you know, they spent more time there than they spent down in the other end of the building where their locker was located. They ate lunch there. They ate dinner there. They'd spend their study halls there.
Let me ask you, as an educator, what did you do to create that safe space for all of those kids that they felt like they could come into your choir room and be loved for who they were?
Well, making them a part of the decision-making process, being willing to listen and not just to music stuff. Sometimes I felt like a parent. Sometimes I felt like a guidance counselor. I was proofreading senior papers. I was helping with homework, except for math. I can't do math. I'm sorry. But
did you have a psychologist couch in the middle of like Freud? Yeah.
I felt like I probably should. But they would just lay on the floor. It's okay. It's, mm-hmm. But yeah, it was just a place where, you know, we would eat together and have lunch and just talk about whatever was going on. And so if there were boyfriend problems, you know, I'd try to deal with it as best I could.
Do you miss it?
I do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I still have an opportunity to interact with high school kids as an adjudicator, and I just finished up a term as NISMA All-State coordinator for vocal jazz, and so I do workshops and I guest conduct and that kind of thing. So still have an opportunity to work with kids, and it's just no better than that.
Well, that sounds like you're talking about spiritual experiences when you talk about the vibrations of the universe. And I can't remember the name of the physicist who suggested that, you know, the universe was literally held together by vibration, you know, the atoms, the energy of the nucleus, and I can't even explain it, and neither could he, but the idea that when you make music, you're literally like tapping into the energy of the universe itself, you
exactly.
know?
Exactly, yeah.
It's a really interesting idea.
There was a series of presentations that were on CD that I play for my kids. I think it was called Music in the Brain. And one of the elements that was particularly striking was when they talked about very young children and, you know, how they responded to music and how they used intervals and things like that without even knowing what they were doing. You know, the minor third is the universal instrument. Mama, you know, and just little things like that that really put into perspective just how small we are in the bigger thing that is art, I guess. Yeah.
Well, since you retired, how long has it been since you?
6 years.
What has been most interesting to you as a musician that's free to do whatever he likes at this point?
Oh, probably I'm having a great time with one of your colleagues, Michael Lasser.
Oh, yeah.
And we've been, actually, Michael and I go back to the 80s, and he has had me do some work with him when he was at the Harley School. And for the last 16 years or so, a wonderful singer, Cindy Miller, and I have been working with him. And he's been sending us all over the country doing these concerts and
these
lecture
are
concerts.
Songs from the Great American Songbook on various themes.
Yeah, it's basically what he does on the radio show, mm-hmm. where how he does it every week, coming up with a new essay, and instead of recorded period recordings, he hires Cindy and I, and we provide the music. So we've done all of the great songwriters and lyricists from the Great American Songbook, but we also pursue societal changes, regional interests, you know, songs of the Midwest, songs of the South, songs of the West, historical markers. We did a series of concerts about the Civil War during the 150th anniversary of the Civil War. And we just finished up a series of concerts for the anniversary of World War I, our entrance into World War I. And we did probably half a dozen concerts around the country of the World War I songs. We've done World War II, and it just goes on and on. We probably have 30, 35 different concerts that we've done.
How has learning those songs changed the way you see history?
Well, Michael, as you know, has a wonderful way of putting music in context and explaining how music can actually change history and how history can change music and how they're intertwined. So when I sing a song that perhaps used to be just a nice song and then it's put in the context of, you know, the history or, you know, the backstory of the composer or the lyricist or something like that, it makes it completely different and so much more meaningful.
For example?
Well, we did a World War I concert at the World War I Museum in, I think it was Kansas City. We did a concert of World War I songs, and particularly songs about a mother sending her son into battle and regretting, you know, what could possibly happen. And the curator of the museum took us for a tour of the museum, and just a little thing, but there was in a case, there was a little French postcard of a scantily clad female. And they said that this was something that the doughboy would carry in their pocket. And before they went into battle, they'd take it out of their pocket and they'd put it in their tent, because if they got killed, anything that was on their person would go to their mother. And they didn't want their mother to see a scantily clad female on a postcard.
That's adorable.
Yeah, I know. And so when you sing something like, "I didn't want my son to be a soldier," you know, a little story, a backstory like that, all of a sudden brings it to life, you know, because there's real people and real experiences and real pathos in the song itself. So,
yeah, and that universal truth about mothers and sons, and, you know.
Exactly, yeah.
That's probably been going on since, you know, the Garden of Eden, for sure.
Yeah.
You're still involved in church music at the Downtown United Presbyterian Church?
I am, yes.
Yeah. What is your role there, and what is interesting to you in that role?
Well, I guess I'm listed as associate musician, but I sing in the bass section of the choir with Lee Wright, and Lee and I often collaborate for improvisatory preludes or postludes, which is very interesting, because he'll call me on a Friday and said, "We're going to do a postlude on, you know, this particular tune, and I'll see you about a half an hour before rehearsal, and we'll work that out." I used to get all worried about that.
So you were playing the piano?
I was playing the piano, uh-huh. and oftentimes he would play violin, and similar to what we did with the first inversion performance in September. We'd sit down and, you know, we'd work out a roadmap and say, "Okay, well, you do this and you do that." And before too long, you know, we just let the spirit move us and boom, an improvised prelude or postlude comes out. And sometimes it's really amazing. We look at each other and say, "Holy cow, where did that come from?" You know, but that's a lot of fun. And we have a jazz service every year during the jazz festival, and so we bring in some luminaries like Herb Smith and Christian Chyner McGuire on drums, and a lot of area musicians to play with us, and of course, jazz is where I'm feeling comfortable, so I always have a good time with that service.
Yeah, that's interesting, you know, that sometimes singers can't improv very comfortably, you know, that you can do both improv and, you know, play it straight,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, the church, I would say they're lucky to have you. As they say, like, no one ever leaves church humming the sermon, right? And that is the power of music.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And if it can enhance the lectionary and the message that's being sent that day, then that's what it's all about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You have any plans for the future? The big changes on the horizon? Are you content where you are?
I'm content. Yeah, having a good time. And enjoying the travel with Michael. We just got back from L.A. a little bit ago, and we're heading to Georgia next week. And we got Baltimore and Sarasota and St. Pete shortly down the road. So all different concerts, by the way. So Cindy and I have quite a bit of rehearsal to do between now and then. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, I wish you well. Is there anything, Alan, that I haven't asked you about that you wanted to mention while we're sitting here?
I just want to mention how grateful I am to you and the entire team here at WXXI for the programming that you provide and the service that you give this community. It's truly awesome, whether it be TV or AM or FM radio. I'm tuned in all the time. It's educational. It's inspiring. It's entertaining. It's thought-provoking.
Oh, thank you.
And it's just so valuable to all of us. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, pleasure.
Thanks for coming in.